only $30 million in lost inventory and inventory that wasn't able to be procured impacted over $3 billion in top line revenue sales of automotives just in 2021 alone. And that type of opportunity cost is part of why you're seeing leadership and C-suites across the industry really looking at procurement operations.
Growing a business requires a holistic approach that extends beyond sales and marketing. This approach needs alignment among people, processes, and technologies. So if you're a business owner, operations, or finance leader looking to learn growth strategies from your peers and competitors, you're tuned into the right podcast. Welcome to the WBS Podcast, where scalable growth using business systems is our number one priority. Now, here is your host, Sam Gupta.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the WBS Podcast. I'm Sam Gupta, your host and principal consultant at digital transformation consulting firm Elevate IQ. As a procurement leader, if you're too focused on seeking discounts, sometimes you might lose sight that the cost of spend could be higher than the discount you might be seeking. Also, as the number of SKUs increases in your organization, the SG&A costs rise at an increasing rate than your top line because of increased marginal overhead with each SKU. The cost of spend is a key metric that manufacturers and distributors need to measure and control, or you might hit the growth inflection point. In today's episode, we have our guest, Edmund Zagarin, who describes why the cost of spend is an important metric for some of these strategic sourcing categories. He also touches on various strategic sourcing terms and processes, such as how to interpret the implications of purchase price variance KPI and why it's important. Finally, he touches on why businesses should be forecasting the outcome to reduce the cost of spend and better manage supplier relationships. Let me introduce Edmund to you. Edmund Zagarin is the founder and CEO of BidOps, the first company that automates vendor negotiation through artificial intelligence. Number-wise, they have done over 100K deals with 2x savings on project on average. In 2019, they also received $1.75 million in seed funding. With that, let's get to the conversation. Hey, Edmund. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Sam. Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
And I am super excited to have you as well. Obviously, you bring tons of experience in specific categories in some of the industries that our listeners are going to enjoy this episode so much. Just to kick things off, do you want to start with your personal story and your current focus, Edmund?
Yeah, Sam, I'd be happy to. My background is in strategic sourcing and really helping companies build processes to collect and compare quotes from suppliers, negotiate great deals, and also understand the total cost of ownership associated with a particular supply chain or category. I started BidOps because I saw that there was a real challenge with email and spreadsheets-based processes creating data silos that made it really difficult for teams at companies to align and communicate. And that's really where we're going today.
Okay, amazing. And obviously, we'll be digging into the strategic sourcing and the specific categories that you just mentioned. But before we do that, we have one of the standard questions that we ask every single guest. And that is going to be your perspective on business growth.
Yeah, I'm happy to share that. I think that for procurement and supply chain and strategic sourcing, growth is, you know, it's a constant. The profession has changed so much since I got involved in it. There's been a lot of growth in the technology, but also the function and the importance within companies. So there, the growth of the kind of impact that procurement can make on a company's bottom line and actually its overall operations. And then from, you know, the perspective of startups, it's, you see much higher growth in the early days, as you often have to go after pretty big problems. And in our case, we deal with people all around the world, different languages, different cultures, really helping people get a common understanding of the issues that they face and then work together collaboratively to find the best solution. So that's really our perspective on growth. It's a team effort. We don't believe that growth is, generally speaking, driven by solo individuals striking out with a purely contrarian opinion. It's really about bringing people together around a shared vision for success.
Yeah, you are so right. And it's very rare that I hear from people that they are thinking of growth to be team mindset. So it's great that you shared that perspective. And one more comment that you mentioned is overall growth in technology in the procurement space. I guess in last 5 to 6 years, the number of technologies that we have seen and the kind of things that you can do using those technologies, the life of a procurement person has changed dramatically, in my opinion, and overall procurement organization has changed as well. So let's say if our listeners may not be familiar with what categories fall under strategic sourcing and what strategic sourcing is, can you break down some of the categories that are going to fall under strategic sourcing and the one that you really specialize in?
Absolutely. So procurement as a category of operations generally encompasses two processes at most companies. One is called procure to pay, which involves invoices and purchase orders getting matched together so that you can pay your supplier partners. The other is frequently referred to as source to contract, which involves discovering, qualifying, and often, understanding the pricing and negotiation aspects of suppliers. And from a data standpoint, really involves requesting information about a supplier's capabilities, getting quotes for, in some cases, thousands of line items at once and comparing them, and then understanding the total cost of ownership and the service levels that the supplier is going to be able to provide, and then also managing that relationship over time. So strategic sourcing really focuses on that front end activity. It can apply to existing suppliers as well as brand new suppliers that you've never heard of. And generally, it then feeds into an ongoing cyclical approach, which at most companies is called category management, and can sometimes include contract management as well, at very least managing the contract expiration dates and making sure that you have the right projects, in advance and following those expiration dates.
Yeah, interesting. So let's talk about these nuances of different categories that we have been discussing so far in the preparation for this interview. And you mentioned that there are nuances of these categories, especially when we look at, let's say, packaging the indirect services, the MRO, and the process for those is going to be fairly different. And those are the categories that you focus on just because, number one, they are different. And number two, they are going to have very different process overall from the category perspective.
Sam, you make a really good point. And I think that in most companies, you have finance and operations that are kind of looking at this set of problems. Yeah. And finance is saying, how can we make sure that we're getting the best pricing? How can we save money consistently where we need to be saving money? Operations is saying, how can we have great relationships with our suppliers and how can we get the right materials, services, packaging, trucks, and so on to show up at the right place at the right time? And so strategic sourcing and category management has to balance those competing objectives. And of course, you have legal compliance as well. And the super categories that we focus on are MRO, which is maintenance, repair, and operations, packaging, logistics, raw materials, which can encompass things like raw chemicals, ingredients that goes in food, as well as components. And then, of course, you have indirect services, which can be a whole host of partnerships ranging from marketing to finance to contingent labor. even things like call centers, which could be large projects and could include elements of services, as well as, you know, SaaS licenses, IT, and so on. What we've seen is that across the industry, as the number of SKUs that a company manages increases, SG&A costs rise disproportionate to top line revenue. And this dynamic is troubling if you're a CFO, because you're seeing costs rise, but not necessarily seeing the benefits of that increase in cost. But it also creates an opportunity for strategic sourcing. So that is primarily how strategic sourcing drives cost savings, is it efficiently aggregates spend. So if you buy the same types of items from fewer suppliers, you can often get volume-based discounts. And this aggregation potential is primarily what drives the return on investment and business case behind strategic sourcing initiatives within major companies. Now, when we dig into this, we see there are specific industries, and I want to talk about automotive just as an example, where in order to sell a car, you have to buy the components, the labor, the assembly, the packaging, in order to produce the car and actually you know, hit your fill rate targets for the dealerships and for your customers. In industries like this, where procurement operations is a critical aspect of top line revenue, what we've seen over the past few months is there's a huge bottleneck, because the technology associated with sell side has gotten so much better over the past 20 years with the advent of cloud platforms like Salesforce and this huge ecosystem of technologies that plug in there. Whereas the technology stack on procurement operations has not caught up, has not improved as quickly. And what we've seen is now there is headline news every day about shortages, supply disruptions. You see microchips in the automotive industry as kind of a you know, critical example of this. And I saw a statistic the other day that I thought was fascinating, where Serif analysis showed that only $30 million in lost inventory and inventory that wasn't able to be procured impacted over $3 billion in top line revenue sales of automotives just in 2021 alone. And that type of opportunity cost is part of why you're seeing leadership and C-suites across the industry really looking at procurement operations and trying to dig in and understand where are the bottlenecks, how do they create backlogs, and how can they create operational risk that could result in, you know, shutting down production, you know, short inventory, real challenges.
Yeah, so there are some very interesting insights here overall when you mentioned the number of the SG&A cost disproportionately increasing because of your number of SKUs. And then you mentioned a couple of points about the automotive industries as well. So all of that is interesting. So let's go back to the you know, comment about why the cost increases disproportionately when the SKUs are increasing. Is it primarily because you don't have as much control in the process? Is it because a lot of vendors are there? Can you touch a little bit more on the reasons why this happens?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you think about any administrative process associated with procurement, there's a cost. There's a cost to read a document, send an email, to evaluate a quote. In direct materials, logistics, and packaging specifically, there's a huge process cost associated with correct allocation. So just as an example, you have a company like BASF that has used BidOps in a couple of categories, including MRO. And they did a bid for 5,000 line items of screws and fasteners associated with multiple different plant locations. They're putting out that bid to 8 different suppliers, each of which is going to bid on different subsections of the 5,000 line items. And then what the analyst has to do is match up all of those quotes in a pivot table and determine which supplier that meets the technical specifications at the line item level and the operational requirements at the lead time level is going to be approved for each plant location. And that task can take weeks or months. So that's an area where we're seeing, as you have more and more SKUs, you have more and more analyst time that's required to manage them. And so intrinsically, you're seeing headcount increases as the requirement to turn around cycles faster becomes shorter and shorter. And so larger companies have whole teams of analysts that do nothing but this task over and over again, understanding what the best price that meets the requirements for each line item is at scale for each plant location, factory, and even, you know, national or international category.
Yeah, very interesting. So I would like to dig a little deeper into overall, you know, how to draw this insight so that our SMB manufacturers can take advantage of that, right? So I don't know how many of the SMB companies really pay attention to this cost because of increase in number of in these SKUs. So let's say if I were looking at my financial statement as the manufacturing executive, and I am looking at my monthly SG&A cost for, let's say, last 24 months. Now, I am drawing that against, I don't know, number of SKUs, right? So what kind of increment am I looking at to be able to identify that, no, I mean, this is definitely a red flag, that the admin cost is increasing to an extent that I may have some opportunities to be able to aggregate either my vendors or optimize my supply chain process. So let's say if you were to draw this graph for your company, Edmund, where would you find that, this is definitely a red flag. Is it like 10%, 20%, 30%?
You know, it really does depend on the categories that manage are really relevant to your business.
Yeah.
And what I would say is it's not really the percentage at a holistic level. Okay. It's the percentage change over the previous year. The other thing I would say about, we would say 3 to 5% would be certainly, kind of red flag territory the number of SKUs are driving SG&A costs up that can create a savings opportunity. But for SMB manufacturers, there are other ways to see whether or not this issue is affecting you. Okay. I would say the primary one is to look at your logistics costs and see what the trends look like over time. If you're seeing that you're paying a lot of rush fees associated with short-term shipments, if you're seeing that you're paying demurrage costs associated with deliveries showing up at the same time and then trucks needing to wait in line at the loading dock, those are indications that a small amount of optimization could have a huge impact on your bottom line.
Okay, very interesting insight. And I don't know how many manufacturers are really allocating this cost and tracking this cost independently. But let's say if I'm looking at my P&L and I am trying to find out, okay, what is my SG&A cost on the P&L? Obviously, when you look at the SG&A, there could be a lot of different elements that may not be directly relevant with the SKUs. So what are different attributes that you are looking at on the P&L statement to drive, okay, this is the SG&A cost for these SKUs that I'm trying to compare?
So the way that we think about it at BitOps is an idea that we call cost of spend.
Okay.
And cost of spend is inclusive of SG&A costs based actually on an hourly basis. So we ask the question, how many hours are you spending, is your team spending on each of these tasks, and how much is an hour of your team worth? And so typically for a team, let's say you have a one person procurement team and maybe they're 50% something else like finance or administration. If they're spending, 4 to 8 hours a week, on this, then perhaps they're not spending that much in SG&A, and so the SG&A impact is relatively minimal. But if you're not monitoring this work stream very closely, then that cost could be showing up in other ways. That's where the cost of spend idea is really powerful. So a good example of this is for a large manufacturer, we looked at packaged gas category. Yeah. So this is gas that's being brought in to serve as part of a process manufacturing work stream. And what we found, the category was around $6.5 million. For this manufacturer, it wasn't considered a large category. So if you know, you do ABC analysis. This was solidly in the B section of that. They were actually seeing 15% of that category was cost of spend. So, you know, that's a significant amount of money. And cost of spend was primarily from actually logistics charges that were optional or incidental because of the way that the gas was being ordered and the process that was being used for collecting quotes and the cycle time that it took to get a purchase order to the supplier. So all of those factor into the cost of spend. And by making one change, by seeing that data in real time, it was possible for this manufacturer to reduce that optional cost completely.
That's very interesting. And I don't know if there are going to be any other KPIs, but cost of spend is definitely very interesting KPI. And I want to make sure that I understand this. So is it when I'm looking at cost of spend KPI, am I looking at cost per $1,000? Is it per PO? Can you describe a little bit more in terms of how this KPI works?
Typically, we recommend that people do cost of spend analysis at a category level.
Okay.
And that it includes a estimate, right? For this, it's much more important to get an estimate, and then you can drill down to perfect it. But just to understand if it's worth looking at all, which I think is the first question that, you know, analysts will ask. So for a category, how much time are you spending managing it? And also, what is the cost of not managing it effectively?
Yeah.
So typically for manufacturers, the cost of not managing a category effectively is incidental costs that are added to invoices in the form of rush orders, late fees, weekend or late deliveries, demurrage charges, and other incidental or operational costs associated with getting the material, component, ingredient to the right place at the right time, meeting the packaging and other operational requirements. Then you have the amount of hours that you're spending managing that category. And when you combine those, you get your cost of spend. Now, the other thing that we do include within cost of spend is exceptions.
Okay.
So exceptions would be if you have another KPI, let's say purchase price variance, which is a very common KPI for manufacturers to look at their purchasing behavior. If that KPI is way off and you're spending a lot of time managing it, then something's wrong. And that would also be incorporated within cost of spend. So super high purchase price variance would be an example of cost of spend.
Okay. And since you mentioned purchase price variance, and if the listeners might not be familiar with that or they might not be tracking it, can you talk a little bit more about that, why it is important, and what are different factors that drive that specific account?
Yeah, for sure. Purchase price variance has actually in recent years become somewhat controversial within the Institute for Supply Management community. And so I want to say that it is an important metric to track, but it's not a metric that you should necessarily live or die by in the case of measuring the success of a category or even of a team. But just to dig into what it is first.
Yeah.
So purchase price variance is often done at the part number level because you often get the same part number from different distributors potentially or different manufacturers potentially. And this part number shows up in spend at different prices. And so purchase price variance as a KPI just asks the question, what are the differences in price that you're paying for the, you know, essentially the same part? And, you know, what would it look like if you got all of the same part number at the best price? And so positive purchase price variance generally indicates that, you know, you have a savings opportunity. Negative purchase price variance indicates that it's trending, you know, in the direction of going down. So, you're doing something right, theoretically. It could also just indicate, though, that your part is impacted by a market. Maybe your part's made of copper and is impacted by the copper market. And, the trends in that market are moving in one direction or another. So it could be something that you have a lot of control over. And it could be something that you could drive savings through running some sourcing projects But it could also be being driven by market factors or forces that you might not have a ton of control over.
Very interesting. So now let's move the conversation towards some of these industries. And I know that you do a lot of work in the automotive sector. And in the automotive sector, the sourcing processes or the way you are going to structure your parts and components are going to be very different from the other industries. So what are some of the nuances that you have seen across these industries and what makes, let's say, the automotive uniquely challenging?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's very timely because we've heard a lot recently about the microchip shortage. There's a huge conversation around this. Front page news, you're also seeing action from the Biden administration on American supply chains actually focused on semiconductors and chip manufacturers, in part due to some of the pressure and challenges that the automotives have faced. And, you know, I think one of the things that will, you know, has to be part of the conversation is just-in-time manufacturing.
Yeah.
And you had for years this group of consultants that really emphasized working capital optimization. In other words, holding as little inventory as possible in order to support your production process, because of course you do pay money in warehousing costs and other costs to hold inventory. And so the idea is that if you can choreograph your supply chain so that the right truck shows up at the right time and you really assert that as a fundamental premise of your operations, then you can save a lot of money and drive a lot of efficiencies. And, you know, we just had a conversation, including this procurement director, Sam Sharma at Airgas, who commented, I thought quite astutely, that for years, the supply chain has been focused on efficiency, but efficiency is the other side of the coin from resiliency. And so some of what you're seeing now in automotive is, to an extent, the chickens of efficiency coming home to roost in the form of short levels for inventory. And the thing that I think a lot of listeners might not know if they're not working in the automotive industry is that this is affecting more than just microchips. There are many categories, not just in terms of production parts, which are, you know, things that go in the assembly and ultimately go into the car, but also indirect materials, spare parts, things that go into the machines within the factory. These are part of the MRO, maintenance, repair, and operations category. And the challenge there is not just maintaining, you know, safe stocking levels and par levels from an inventory standpoint, but in terms of sourcing, if you might have a bottleneck that might not be related to a true shortage or supply, but is actually created by your suppliers, relatively speaking, relying on labor instead of technology. And so if there's a labor shortage in the supply chain, then all of a sudden, the number of orders that your supplier is capable of processing per day decreases dramatically at the same time that your need to place those orders increases. And so that is almost a textbook bottleneck. Where you're seeing, you know, large automotives that say, hey, we need these parts. Hey, we need these components. But the suppliers are saying, we don't have enough people who are here to service those orders or to process those orders. And so I live in San Francisco, and San Francisco is known for having long lines at restaurants. You walk around the city, you see people waiting in line to get ice cream, get coffee, all different kinds of things. And so I would analogize what's happening in the automotive supply chain to a restaurant that has a very, very long line. And when it gets long enough, it's too long to be worth it to stand in line. And you say, okay, that restaurant's off limits. I'm not going to consider it because the wait's too long. And so then, oh, there are no restaurants that are open. So that's what's happening in the automotive space. You see, it's not as if we've run out of any of these parts. In the case of microchips, there are, you know, actual shortages, but across the supply chain, we've run out of available supply that can meet the manufacturer lead time, where the line is short enough that it's worth waiting in it. And so When that happens, you see production shutdowns. You see companies that say, wow, it's going to be cheaper for us to close the factory, even during a time of peak demand where people are desperate to buy cars, people are desperate to buy our products. But we, you know, if we have a factory open and we can't get supply for this category, we're not going to be able to make the car. So it's cheaper for us to actually shut the whole factory down and, you know, reopen it when we have supply back in than to stay open without being able to produce at the capacity that, you know, our business model is based on.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So now we are going to be discussing the comment that you had made, one of the comments that I found really insightful, to be honest, in the pre-show, and that was forecasting the outcome, right? And this is something you guys focus on a lot. So when you are talking about mimicking this whole supply chain process and pre-visualizing the supply chain process, so how are you guys helping in forecasting the outcome and how that is going to help the whole automotive supply chain from the OEM perspective as well as from the supplier perspective?
Yeah, Sam, I'm happy to share this. And, you know, I know that your listeners will probably appreciate me being as specific as possible, because it's easy to use words like automate or optimize, but, you know, let's kind of get down to the details and you know, share what's actually going on here.
Yeah.
So we, you know, BitOps launched our software package with companies like BASF, AutoTruck, which manufactures custom trucks, a number of other players in the automotive supply chain. And what we did is we said, if we could suggest the price to a supplier before they submit a quote, what's the likelihood that they would accept that? You know, and when we began this journey, we did this process with a group of, you know, humans like us sitting in a room making models using Excel and a number of other programs and literally just collaborating with the procurement teams we were helping to put these models out and see what the supplier's response was.
Okay.
And what we found was shocking. Suppliers, in many cases, especially for lower value line items, are willing to accept the suggested price, particularly if they believe it's competitive, because they know that other suppliers are being shown the same or similar prices. And if they deviate significantly from that, then they could miss out on a business opportunity. So what we realized is that doing this manually, there was a huge opportunity for machine learning.
Yeah.
And I want to be very specific about how machine learning works in this context, because it's pretty cool. So typically you have a training set and a validation set of data. You train a model on the training set, and then you ask the model to spit out a result. And then you compare that result against the validation set of data to see if the result was correct. If, you know, if it's not correct, then there's a difference in that, which, you know, we say it's a loss, you know, loss rate on the target variable, and then it can back propagate into the initial model. And that's what helps the model get smarter. So in the context of price negotiations, we saw there was a huge opportunity for active learning, which is where you have this, this loop, essentially working in a production environment. And so what happens, kind of in the early days of BitOps is we deploy this model, and it begins to suggest prices to suppliers. And when the supplier accepts the price, it tells the model, okay, good job. This was valid. So that's the validation step. The, you know, the training is done before the price negotiation begins. So it simulates the pricing based on a number of variables, which I can discuss in a sec. Gives that to the supplier. Supplier says looks good or doesn't look good and changes it. And when the supplier changes it or submits a quote, it tells the model, okay, here's how off you were for this type of line item. So that was kind of like the early days of BitOps, just doing a lot of that.
Yeah.
And then what we realized was that we had a model that was really, really good at forecasting the outcome of a negotiation or really any procurement activity before it began, based off of the variables of how competitive it was, how complex it was, and really how much time the procurement team was asking for the supplier to spend on completing the task. Because, and this was fascinating to me, just being interested in behavioral economics and human psychology and kind of how people think about these things. But if you can make it really easy for a sales team to submit a quote, they're often so engaged in that process that they're willing to be more creative on pricing and in some cases more loose on pricing. Whereas if you take, if you force a sales team to spend a long time coming up with pricing model and a quote, then they're invested in that as their price and they're much less willing to budge on it. Now, today, we know that lots of procurement teams don't necessarily love the idea of suggesting a price to a supplier for lots of reasons. And so what BidOps enables is we have this simulation price prediction engine that to a very high degree of accuracy, and today it's actually over 92%, is able to say what the price is going to be based off of the number of suppliers, the number of line items, and metadata associated with the baseline bill of materials.
Okay, very interesting. So you were going to touch on those variables as well. I don't know if you have covered all of them. Do you have anything to add from the variables perspective that is driving the model?
Yeah, absolutely. So the main variables are competition, the number of line items actually in the bid, so like the complexity associated with the bid, as well as the number of requirements. And then one variable that I didn't mention, but which is important, and I think if you work in procurement and supply chain, you might recognize this just from, it's something that's actually very common for sourcing managers to do manually, is to actually look at the cost distribution in a bid.
Okay.
So typically, sourcing managers are used to thinking about the Pareto cost distribution, which is where, 80% of the bid's financial value is contained in 20% of the line items.
Yeah.
And the rest is sometimes called the long tail of the bid.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that there are tons of other patternistic cost distributions in bidding. And they actually correspond patternistically with how suppliers think about a willingness to discount. And so we took the behavioral economics idea of willingness to pay, flipped it around, and created a model that estimates willingness to discount at the line item level based off of attributes of the sourcing activity. So again, understanding whether or not there are competitive alternatives, understanding how long the process and how complex the process is for the supplier, and then also understanding how is the cost distributed? Are there one or two line items that are really kind of the, where the supplier's, eyes are going to be on from a size of the prize perspective, or are all of the line items pretty evenly spaced? Because people will perceive that value in relationship to the other line items in the bid. A $10 million line item sounds great, but if every other line item is much, much higher, then it's not going to be discounted as heavily than if it's the only $10 million line item in a bid that's filled with, $100,000 line items.
Okay, very interesting. So one of the things that I am still trying to figure out in understanding this model, so I completely get that if each time that you are doing a bid or a purchase, then you are trying to utilize that feedback loop to understand whether your model is accurate or not. And as you spend more time, as you can gather more data over the period of time, the model is going to be slightly more accurate. It's going to be intelligent. That's basic machine learning. Now, let's talk about the initial model. And I don't know if you are sharing this data with the other folks as well, or is it going to be just, let's say, if you are working with manufacturer A. Now, is this data going to be just related to manufacturer A, or all of the manufacturer or the distributor or whoever is buying that specific category? Are you going to combine all of those insights in your model? And is that how you are predicting your model accuracy? So two things I want you to touch on. Number one, where did the initial model come from? Because you didn't really have any sort of data at that point of time. And number two is going to be if you are sharing the data and the insight to build your model.
Sam, those are both great questions. And I want to break down a couple things about how the model works that come up a lot of times when we're talking with finance leaders or procurement leaders. So the first thing is our model is totally unrelated to the identity of the line item. Okay. So it factors in things like quantity and things like competition, complexity, yeah. and so on. But it wouldn't actually be meaningful at all to have a concept of this idea of like kind of sharing data, you know, across different manufacturers, except yeah. to yeah. say that if we, let's say manufacturer A has a bid where the line items, you know, three line items and they're each $100,000.
Yeah.
They bid them out across five suppliers and they see that there's a, you know, that they, you know, it's a 12% savings. And, you know, that data, that 12% for three line items for, you know, it took them 20 minutes to bid and all of that, that high level metadata does feed back into the model that's used for everyone. And so at that very, very high level, it does get smarter, but it the model doesn't need to know what you're sourcing. And the reason that that's important is because we can actually generate forecasts and really useful intelligence for things that a company has never sourced before. It's a one-off purchase. It's not recurring. And importantly, there's no record for it in our data set.
Okay, amazing. Thank you so much for all of that. That's it for today. Do you have any last minute closing thoughts?
I think that if there's one thing I could leave the listenership with in terms of thinking about innovation in general in procurement and supply chain, procurement, strategic sourcing, contract management, category management, supply chain are often considered back office functions that are, you know, not necessarily always appreciated or recognized or prioritized by the C-suite. And I would say 2021, now's our time. You know, this is the time for any team that is driving significant value to the top line revenue of the business to say, here's what our vision for the future is. And so whether, you know, that's using data in a different way, building supplier relationships in a different way, if there's a project you've always wanted to do but haven't had the budget or the bandwidth to do yet, I would say seize the moment, because there is a lot of really good evidence that shows that procurement and supply chain teams that get quick wins in innovation projects are able to better recruit for open roles. They're better able to align with other departments in the company. They're better able to win recognition and often have bigger budgets and more headcount because the contribution that they're making to the company is better recognized. And so if you feel that you aren't getting your due or that your work hasn't been recognized to the extent that it should be, seize the moment. And, you know, the spotlight is on supply chain in 2021. So it's an exciting time to be working in this area. And I think that I'm hearing from a lot of colleagues that change is in the air. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, and my personal takeaway from this conversation is going to be, I don't know how many small to medium sized manufacturers and distributors pay attention to their SG&A over the period of time. So pay attention to that and figure out how to measure cost of spend, because that's really important overall in optimizing your supply chain, in making sure that your admin expense is not more than the discount that you are trying to seek from your vendor. On that note, Edmund, I really want to thank you for your time. This has been a powerful episode.
Sam, thanks so much for having me.
I cannot thank our guests enough for coming on the show, for sharing their knowledge and journey. I always pick up learnings from our guests, and hopefully you learned something new today. If you want to learn more about Edmund, head over to bidops.com. Links and more information will also be available in the show notes. If anything in this podcast resonated with you and your business, you might want to check other related episodes, including the interview with Christine Von Pender, who discusses the procurement process for food packaging equipment. Also, the interview with Mark Sanchez, who discusses selling to and negotiating with FMCG buyers with buying environments where they need to make quick decisions and move fast. Also, don't forget to subscribe and spread the word among folks with similar backgrounds. If you have any questions or comments about the show, please review and rate us on your favorite podcasting platform or DM me on any social channels. I'll try my best to respond personally and make sure you get help. Thank you, and I hope to catch you on the next episode of the WBS Podcast.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the WBS Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform so you never miss an episode. For more information on growth strategies for SMBs using ERP and digital transformation, check out our community at wbs.rocks. We'll see you next time.